Welcome to Book and Lounge. I'm your host, Jacqueline. In this episode, I'm joined by Remington Blackstaff to discuss his novel, The Durbar's Apprentice. Remington was born in Nigeria and moved to the UK as a child. He attended the Priory School and the prestigious Dulwich College before going off to medical school. He practices as a GP in London, where he lives with his wife and son. He's obsessed with martial arts, rugby, and cinema. The Durbar's Apprentice, which is set in 17th century Nigeria, chronicles the adventures of a warrior and his ward. It is his debut novel. Let's join the conversation. So, welcome Remington to Book and Lounge. Today we are going to be talking about your book, The Durbar's Apprentice, which is your debut novel. And before I get into the book itself, I just wanted to ask you some get-to-know questions so that listeners can get to know you as well.
Sure.
And so the first thing I'm going to ask, which I found quite intriguing, when I was sent your book, I looked at it and I was expecting, a writer from the Caribbean. And then when I read your bio, I'm like, Remington, Blackstaff, Nigerian? I was like,
that doesn't sound
very Nigerian at all. So if you could just explain, I guess, your name.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you very much for having me on your podcast. I'm very grateful to be on there. Yes, you are right. It is a pseudonym. The main reason being is because of my line of work as a GP, working in mental health. I work with some very ill people who, because of the nature of their illnesses, can become fixated on things or people. And I just thought it'd be much easier practicing as a doctor to be anonymous and write under a pseudonym, unless the Netflix money or Disney comes buying the rights to this book and I quit being a doctor tomorrow. I'd like to carry on working and just work, protecting the privacy of my patients and my family and just live a normal life. So I just thought it'd be easier. So I am Nigerian. I have a very Nigerian name, but my pseudonym is based on my formative years when I was doing martial arts. That's as much as I'll say for now, but there is a story behind it.
I was going to ask you how you actually chose the name, but there's a story behind it. Maybe we'll come to it a bit later.
Maybe.
Right. So you were born in Nigeria and then you moved to the UK at a young age. And then you've done basically all of your schooling in the UK and now live here with your family.
Yes.
You're a very keen martial arts person. You've done multiple disciplines.
Yeah. I mean, I started karate when I was 7, took a bit of a break, started a martial art called Choi Kwang Do when I was 13, did that to the age of 29, 30. I was a third degree black belt, blue tag and head instructor. I didn't have my own school, but my instructor had the school and I was like his number two. So I actually got my black belt when I was it 16 or 15? I'm definitely getting old now, but yeah. But I'm taking a bit of a break now because of a leg injury, but I'm still a very keen martial artist. I think the next thing I want to try my hand at, having done a bit of Kung Fu, is Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Oh, wow.
And now that I have a son, in my fantasy land, I'd like to get him involved, but I think he doesn't quite have the concentration span for it, but we'll see how that pans out.
And then you also wanted to be a stuntman.
Oh, God, I was obsessed with the A-Team, MacGyver, Airwolf, James Bond, everything. I actually used to watch documentaries. And actually, I don't know if Blue Peter was on, it still is now, but when I was a kid, there was a special with a guy called Peter Duncan, and he did this show where they got the big crash mat, he had the James Bond tuxedo, he did some scene on a ship. I remember it very vividly, and I just remember looking at the screen with my mouth open going, wow, that's what I'd love to do. But of course, with Nigerian parents, one of whom was a doctor, and the other one was a school teacher, that was never, ever, ever going to happen.
So you put all of that aside and then you went into medicine, but now you're
right. I think I'm too old to be too old and too stiff to be a stuntman. But now I've discovered this creative side that I guess is the writing. Mm-hmm. The medicine is still there. Ironically, the medicine has unearthed that through, I guess, my experience working in different places. But I think the stuntman days are a lost life, but who knows where this creative journey will take me.
So then, have you always wanted to write?
No, I didn't start writing till 2017.
Wow.
I hadn't written anything since I think I was 15 or 16 when I had to for GCSE English. I did science A levels. I never wrote journals or diaries as a child. In hindsight, I was an avid reader. I remember I had a mobile library near our home in Surrey when I was in my primary school. I'm ashamed to admit I was a school librarian at my secondary school in lunch breaks sometimes. Definitely not a cool thing to say as a 43-year-old man living in North London. But yeah, in terms of actual writing, it was, I mean, I could talk you through that, how that came about.
Sure, yes.
So basically, as a GP, I've worked in the community, I've worked in the military, I've worked in a prison, I've worked for Transport for London, I've worked in professional sport, by which I mean a Premier League team, disability sports, a blind football, an age grade football. And after a while, you talk to people and they go, wow, you should write a book about this. This is amazing. And you're like, well, is it really? And you don't see these things because you're always working. But then you have a lot of experiences. You have these anecdotes that you tell your friends. And then you think, actually, there's a bit of a story here. And on my way back from my honeymoon a few years ago, I met my wife abroad. We're both from abroad. And she said, you used to write me such lovely emails when we were on the other side of the world before we lived together. And she came to the UK. She says, you would make an excellent writer. And I foolishly believed her. And that led to my first manuscript about 6 months later. So I started writing that on the flight back from our honeymoon in Thailand on the long haul flight. I think I wrote the first chapter by the time we landed, because I rolled with that idea. And then that was the first manuscript that I did. Didn't get published, but it was the start.
So was it the manuscript for this book?
No. I've written two previous ones before it.
Okay, well, it definitely was a wise decision, because it's a great book. I absolutely enjoyed reading it.
Thank you very much. That's very, very kind of you.
And so I guess if you could just tell our readers a little bit what the book is about and what inspired it.
So it's a 17th century historical fiction action-adventure novel set in northern Nigeria before it was called Nigeria. There are two warring kingdoms that have been toing and froing for decades, and there's an event that happens. I won't ruin it for the readers, but things are hanging in the balance, and there's a warrior group called the Durbars, and they've been tasked to find out what's going on. And the central character, the central protagonist, is a boy called Issa, and his master is the Durbar warrior, one of the Durbar warriors, but he's the main Durbar warrior. And they go on this journey to try and prevent this war, and things unfold from there. Now, in terms of what inspired it, I wrote two other manuscripts before this. I was actually, having not had the two other manuscripts published, I was writing a fictional story about this doctor working in mental health, who happened to be a British Nigerian, who was some murder mystery kind of thing. And my son was about three or four months old? So he wasn't a good sleeper. To this day, he's not a great sleeper. And so the deal was, because I was the one working, my missus would deal with the nights, and I'd get up as early as I could, and I'd hold him in one arm. And we've got this massive canvas that I bought in Nigeria, this painting about 9 years ago. Anyway, it's in our living room. And when he couldn't sleep, he would just stare at this picture. So I'd hold him in one arm. And I remember one day just texting one of my closest friends, a guy called Ikin Azwike, who he's a big Dutch media personality now, but we went to university. He's part Nigerian, part British. Mm-hmm. And I remember texting him saying, man, it'd be really cool to just write this, you know, this action adventure novel based on these horsemen in this painting. And, you know, when my son grows up one day, he can read about this and just kind of have the thing that we didn't have growing up in the UK. Things have changed a bit now. You have like cartoons with lots of black characters. You have books. Growing up here, we didn't have any of that, you know, back in the early 80s. So I just said, yeah, it'd be cool. And I said, but the thing is, I've started writing this book. I think it was either the Section 12 mental health one or about prison. Anyway, something completely unrelated. And he said to me, it was actually September 2018, because I looked it up the other day, because I keep all my emails. And he was just like, man, you should do it. If you think you can do it. And I was like, yeah, of course I'll do it. So that's how it came about. It was a painting and just my son, this little baby, being hypnotized by this thing. I mean, I've been brought up with the Nigerian culture here. A lot of my dad's friends moved over when he came over. A lot of them are doctors as well. So you always had the weddings, the christenings, the blah, blah, blah. You're always surrounded by it. So you're entrenched in this culture. But when you have a kid, you suddenly feel responsible to pass on that link, even though he's going to have it around him. My parents are still around. They're not that far away. But you suddenly start thinking about him and how he sees himself in this world and his place. And a lot of, I guess, fatherhood and a boy's place in the world, I hope, is reflected in the book.
Right, so can you just read a couple of paragraphs from the book for us so we can get a feel for what the book is like?
Yeah, I'll start with the chapter one.
Mm-hmm.
She was beautiful. The sunlight glistened off her flawless black skin as his fingertips traced a path from Sissoko's muscular thighs, mapping every contour along the way to the nape of her neck. The gentle caresses from the palms of his hands were passively absorbed in alternating mesmerizing strokes, each one coursing its own route along the velvet landscape. The slow corporeal connection between them hovered above Sissoko's racing heartbeat as the canvas was interrupted by his reflection in her dark eyes. For a moment, they stood face to face, each silently transfixed by the affectionate gaze of the other. Appreciating the horse's beauty wasn't solely confined to admiring her at a standstill. In flight, Sissoko glided gracefully, whether moving at a canter or at top speed. Maintaining such a fine creature was one of his greatest pleasures in life, one Issa relished every day. The hairs of her mane were delicately separated by the teeth of the wooden comb, as if they were his own. So that's the opening paragraph to chapter one. And would you like the next one?
Yes, please.
Sure. So this is a separate one, much further in the book. The synchronized chaos of the dancers moved to the rhythm of the kalangu. The drumbeat marshaled the frenetic movements of their bodies and the bamboo canes they brandished. The dancers, in their vibrant, multicolored clothing and painted faces, captivated the live audience, including their esteemed guest. As their feet pounded the red earth, their infectious energy rose to a fever pitch that was palpable among the crowd at the open-air ceremony. A shirtless adolescent boy danced his way from the crowd, unhindered, towards the performers. His arms were slung over a long tree branch, resting behind his neck. As the onlookers cheered on, the dancers continued but cleared space for him until he was center stage among them. The space around the young boy widened, and he was joined by another boy, not much older, but fully clothed and carrying his own bamboo cane. The younger boy stood his ground, and the pace of the drumbeat slowed down. The dancers stopped and looked on. The older boy dropped to a low stance, held his left hand ceremoniously above his head, and with his other hand dragged his cane along the ground. He stared at his younger counterpart intensely as he circled him. Then the first blow came.
Thank you. And I'm so glad you chose that specific part to read, because I absolutely enjoyed how you brought the characters and the scenes to life. Because when I was reading that, I could imagine and I could see the two fighters, I could mm-hmm. see the drums, I could see the people surrounding them. And I found your writing really, really descriptive, but not overly descriptive, but it just so it was so vivid.
Thank you.
I mean, I really enjoyed this book.
Thank you very much.
All the fighting scenes, you kind of have music. How you described the fighting, I could see that you'd really done a lot of research into fighting. But then I read that actually you love choreographing martial arts. I'm like, oh, that explains it.
Yeah. No, I literally lay there at night thinking, okay, do this move. And I remember when I was a teenager and we used to do fairs to, you know, publicize the martial art we were doing, and we'd rehearse. Okay, we're going to have a two-on-one attack. We're going to do a knife drill. Hey, disarm someone attacking with a knife. So in my mind, I'm playing these scenes in my head. I mean, there's probably a part of my soul that is too old to be a stuntman, but would like to be a stunt coordinator if circumstances were different. So I guess the writing is my way of doing it vicariously.
I'm just curious. There's a lot of music. There's a lot of description of the people around. And I just wondered how much of that is a true reflection of the cultures and practices of the time.
Yeah, no, it's true that the characters themselves are fictional, mm-hmm. but the instruments, the buildings, some of the names of the buildings, that's all true. And that rhythm, those drum beats, that hasn't changed through time. And it's not just Nigerian culture, it's African culture in general. And that's whether we go from you know, those historical times to Afrobeat of today, all those things. That is our one defining characteristic, I think, of any African, Caribbean as well. We have that drum beat, there's that rhythm, there's that movement. So that's based on real things. I was compelled to incorporate that into the story.
And so what research then did you do to get the ideas and the story?
Yeah, so a lot of internet research, because that's the most practical way to do things. Mm-hmm. Ironically, I didn't ask my parents, who would have been the first port of call, especially my mum, because she grew up in the north, because I wanted to surprise them. That Nigerian boy who still seeks his father's / mother's approval, it was buried in there. And they actually didn't know about the book till Christmas of last year, when I got an advance copy and gave it to them. So they were well out of the loop for everything. So it was a lot of internet research, bit of memory research from my time going to Kano. Because of work, I didn't have the time to go to the British Library and things like that. And I haven't been to Nigeria for a few years for multiple reasons. So I couldn't do on the ground research. So, you know, structures, places, instruments, items, clothing, factual, the characters, my imagination, the plot. There's a long history of war. I think I took some artistic license with timelines, but there is that history of animosity and warfare between those northern kingdoms. So that is true, just not to the timelines that I used in the book.
What did your parents think of the book? Have they read it?
They have. They really enjoyed it, which was great to hear. The little boy was very happy. My mum is a very, and I mean this in the nicest but most honest way possible, she's a typical fiercely proud, I should say, because she's not fierce, Nigerian woman. And, you know, us Nigerians, I'm actually an anomaly. I'm very quiet for a Nigerian. I'm very quietly spoken, as I've been told my whole life. My late grandmother used to call me Prince Charles. That was her nickname for me. She couldn't speak much English, but she could say Prince Charles very eloquently. So my dad kind of thought, well, you know, he thought my wife had written something when I put the book in his hand, because she's an anthropologist. She's, you know, she's into all the writing and blah, blah, blah. My mum was just speechless, and all she could say was, I'm so proud. And that was a very heartwarming moment for me. So they've thoroughly enjoyed it. They've given it to their friends, a lot of who are from the north. God bless those uncles and aunties. They've loved it, but they've also said, you know, next time, you know, contact us and we will help you write the next one. So, which is kind but not needed.
And so just going back to the book and the setting, so you've set it in northern Nigeria. And I mean, I read a lot of books set in Nigeria. You don't very often find books that are set in the north. And that's another reason why I really like this, because it's allowed me to just find out a bit more about the culture of northern Nigeria. And I know a lot about Igbo culture. I know a lot about Yoruba culture. But rarely do you read a book that's set up in the north. So that's one thing that I was really grateful for. The other thing that you've included is female warriors. And again, that's not something that you normally come across in books, especially books set in that period. And so that's another thing that I was really grateful for. Although I would have liked to have a lot more on the women, especially Ansari women. I wanted to know, how did they get this killed? And you know, I mean, women were not supposed to fight, or at least the Bars were not supposed to get married. How did he get away with it? So I wanted to know a lot, but I know that's probably a completely different story. But what I did want to ask you, when the ladies were in the commune, you very likely touch on LGBT issues. I was curious to find out whether or not that was actually a thing at that time, or whether or not that's something that you've artistic license, basically, you've used to...
There's a bit of artistic license, but there's also... I mean, there was a couple of things that inspired all of that. So my wife has worked in the women's sector in terms of advocacy, domestic violence. She used to work for a women's charity. In fact, she was the deputy manager for a women's charity. So that inspired that aspect of things. Also, I didn't want to make it an all-male story. I probably haven't done a good enough job in terms of incorporating the women. I could probably write a whole new book on that. But also, there's this thing where in African culture, the whole LGBTQI thing, it's this never talked about thing that's my opinion, it's like growing up, you're always meant to be told that, oh, this is a very European thing. This is what white people do. And it's nonsense.
Yeah.
People have been gay since the dawn of time.
Mm-hmm.
What is different is whether it's been documented, it's been hushed up, it's been suppressed. And you'll see more of this in the follow-up to this book. I don't want to say too much, but it's...
So the rumors are true. I heard rumors of a trilogy.
Oh, God, they're true. I'm halfway through the... I actually wrote a book after this, which is completely different. Set in Nigeria, but different timeline, different genre, different everything. But I'm halfway through. I'm on page 196, I believe, of the sequel to this at the moment. But yeah, the LGBTQI thing, people have had their, you know, their own sexual orientation since the dawn of time. I think society has just manipulated how people have been able to express themselves. So that's why I've done it very lightly. I concede that. I've only touched on the surface, but I just wanted to have it in there just to, the same way that I'm trying to, through fiction, say that history is not what you think, and I'll expand on that in a second. I wanted to say, well, actually, that our perception of people's different sexualities is not what you think. It's not something that the white man brought over with colonialism. People have liked who they've liked since the dawn of time, and maybe society has forced them to do it in private, as is the way in modern day Northern Nigeria now. But I just wanted to just have a little something in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that you did include women in the book, and also that it would incorporate a bit of different cultures and different practices that we don't get to read about, things that happened in Africa pre-colonial times. So I was quite glad that actually you included that. I mean, I'm from Uganda, and like in Nigeria, there have been LGBT practices forever. But when you go to Uganda now, everybody will tell you, no, that's a Western thing. That's a Western thing.
That was, and it's nonsense.
Europeans. Yeah, so I'm glad that you've actually put that in the book. My favorite bits to read were of the, I think was it the Sultan of Sokoto? One that was dying. Was it Sokoto Katsina? I can't remember.
It
was
Sokoto, the Sultan, yeah.
Yes. So the one that was being attended by the physicians, that I just found that really interesting to read. I found it quite funny. And I was curious as to what, for you, was your favorite part to write?
That's a tough question. That's a very tough question. The obvious thing would be anything between Master and Issa. I think the most personal bits.
Yeah.
Is, I'm slightly dodging the question, but the most personal bits, I think, were between Durba, Master, and Issa, because I wrote this when I become a dad, and you know, there's things that when you grow up, you know, your fears are, you worry about what happens when your parents aren't around, you know, you're working out your place in the world. And when you become a parent, you don't worry as much about when your parents aren't around, you start worrying about what happens when I'm not around, how will my child or the people I leave behind cope? So I don't know if I succeeded. The readers will tell me whether I did or didn't, but that was something I tried to get across in the book, that relationship, you know, that surrogate fatherhood figure. And also the way you perceive parents, that changes as you get older. So there's a part, I won't ruin it for the potential readers, where one of the characters exacts revenge on a spouse, shall we say, of his mentor on the battlefield. And superficially it's self-defense, but it's actually his response to heartbreak. And while this is observed by, you know, the young boy, you see that adults respond to heartbreak the same way kids do,
mm-hmm.
but in some ways more viciously than kids do. And it's payback for that person who carries out that action, because he can never let it go. And it's for me, it was something about the way you realize when you grow up, when you're a little kid, your dad's Superman. And then when you get older, you realize, well, he's not perfect. And, you know, he has his flaws. He has his darker sides. And that, I think my favorite bits are probably where Issa starts seeing his perception of Master evolves.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very wishy-washy, rambling answer, but it's very hard to...
No, I totally guess it, because I thought the tenderest moments in the book was the relationship between the two of them, where Master would try and tell him things, and he didn't understand what the Master was talking about half the time. But the Master would try and educate him. And I think that there was there's a section where you actually brought me to tears.
Success. Well, my wife and now you, I've succeeded. Done.
I just read it. I was like, wow. It was just so touching. It was they were just in a room together. They were talking. And it was how the Master was talking to him and how Issa was reacting to his Master's condition. Mm. And yeah, it just brought me to tears. I was on a flight and then the guy sitting next to me was like looking at me thinking, what's wrong with her? I just really enjoyed reading about the relationship between the two of them. And I can see now that you explain that it's you exploring how a father relates to a child, I can actually really see that. And the other thing about the Master that I really like, that he was a character of integrity, but he was a flawed character. And so he wasn't perfect. And I like that you did that. And I also like that it ended the way it did. I don't like happy endings.
Yeah, no, I wait till you see the next one. That's not going to be happy at all.
So I like that about it. But what I found about the book is that, well, you've got all the elements of what makes a good book. And I just wondered whether or not you have attended any writing courses. Nothing. Because it's just so perfect.
That's extremely, wow, I've waited 5 years to hear this. That's extremely, extremely kind of you. I think the interesting thing, and it's one of those weird things that happens in life. So when I wasn't getting this picked up by a publisher, I wasn't getting an agent, and I still don't have one to this day, I started writing another book. So just when the pandemic started, and I knew the kind of story I wanted to tell. I wanted it to be in Nigeria, and I wanted to have it, you know, an African story, because that's my thing, my main thing in whatever I write these days is I want things through an African lens. All this, you know, the Western narrative of, look, we've got these bronze statues, then slavery, and now look, Africa. Drives me insane. I want to smash that to bits. I cannot stand the way that us as a continent are perceived. I mean, our leaders recently haven't helped, but that's something I want to change. But I've ranted myself on a tangent and lost where I was.
Now, we were talking about whether or not you've had any writing classes.
Yes, I'm back. He's back. The answer is no. My way of learning has been writing two manuscripts that got nowhere. Getting amazing feedback from my amazing wife. She's not an editor. I mean, she's edited documentaries, but she's not a writing editor by trade. She actually did take creative writing courses, so she's had some training and gave me feedback. But it's basically been feedback from a handful of friends who I thank at the back of the book. One agent who asked for more and ultimately rejected the book, but you know what? I'm still eternally grateful to her. Her name is Johanna Castillo from the Writer's House in New York, because she said, look, we need less exposition, more, you know, what people are feeling. And I was like, cool. So the biggest change that came between when I started and when it got published was going back and adding some of those emotional bits to it. Probably not that much, but enough to make it a better book. Other than that, I got no feedback really from, you know, before the publisher got involved, from anyone. So it was just writing what I thought and listening to what my wife thought. Again, minor little tweaks. So yeah, I've given a very long-winded answer, but I've got no formal writing training at all. It's just my imagination and a lot of trial and error with the previous two manuscripts. I guess having the humility to realize what didn't work, which I can see now, and then just I've remembered where before my tangent, I started writing a different book. Another book after this one, before it got published. I'll give you a little teaser. So it's near future, based in Nigeria, but in the south-ish this time. Completely different genre, crime fiction, thriller, bit of suspense. And I bought this book by Lisa Kron called Wired for Story. And it's about, you know, the neural processes involved in getting people's attention, the neurons that fire when they read stuff so they just can't put the book down. So, you know, giving them as little to process, but as much to enjoy as possible, to massively paraphrase a very good book. So she's got all these chapters. So when I wrote the next book, I literally had it out, or I'd taken screenshots and I had it out next to me while I was writing on my phone, which is how I've written everything. I'll come to that in a second. I don't use a computer or a typewriter. It's all on my iPhone. And there was a point where I stopped and I was like, wow, it's funny because I read this book after The Dove's Apprentice, but while I wasn't getting picked up by anyone, I was reassured by the fact that I'd actually incorporated all her tips in this book that I was later to read in The Dove's Apprentice. So that I guess that gave me, apart from my very reassuring, lovely wife, it gave me a glimmer of hope that this book might someday see the light of day, because some expert on how to write well, her guidelines I've actually done without, I guess, paying for help or getting a formal writing course. So I fumbled my way there in the end, but I got over the finish line, I guess.
Are you an avid reader yourself?
Kind of. I say kind of because my day job doesn't give me that much time. And the way I read is it's a bit like a student. I will say to myself, right, this is your book for the week or 2 weeks. You're going to read this book. You're going to finish it no matter what within this time frame. Whether you have to go to bed an hour later or eat while you're turning the pages with your other hand. So I go through chunks. I'm trying to be disciplined to not just read on holiday. With a child, it's more difficult because you have even less time than you did before. So avid reader through childhood, a bit more through university. As a dad, it's a bit harder, but I'm trying to be hard on myself to read more, but I do like reading. And also as a writer, you do need to read. You don't necessarily learn from other people. When you do, it's great. The downside to that is you also become a more critical reader.
Yes.
But the better the book, the less critical you are. And I've had a couple, I think I read Ghana Must Go by Taye Selassie, and fantastic. There's another guy who is a crime fiction. He's a guy from my school called Ray Celestine. Incredible writer. I mean, the way this dude writes, I don't want to, you know, blow his cover, but you would think he's from 1940s New York or New Orleans or wherever he writes. He's incredible, really talented guy, and a really humble, nice guy as well. So I read him and I learn stuff. I read Taye Selassie and I read stuff. Chimamanda, you know, I'll get on the floor and start prostrating. Incredible writer. Half of the Yellow Sun is one of the greatest books I think has ever been written. I really, really wish they'd made us read stuff like that rather than the nonsense they made us read in school. And I say that with caution. I should probably step on my tongue before I say too much. You know, different horses for different courses. People have taste, but I struggled with having books that I identified with that were part of our school curriculum.
They were not there. No, I mean, I am the same as you. I think the closest I ever came to reading a book that I could identify with was, read a book called Comfort Herself. And it was about a young girl who was put into foster care. She was of mixed background, and she was put into care with a black family, and then she was just grappling with issues of identity.
Yeah,
that's the closest I ever came to reading a book that reflected my reality and my identity. And I'm glad that, you know, you and amongst other writers are actually bringing our stories to life.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I'm grateful for is, you know, in the family house, you know, my dad and my mum had the books by Wole Soyinka and Maya Angelou. So I would read those anyway, but that had nothing to do with my education. You know, even the crime fiction novels I like all the horror things of Stephen King's, again, none of it was at school. I don't think school really, in terms of what the actual curriculum, added anything to my passion for reading. It was stuff that I kind of had from elsewhere. Libraries, I think, for kids are so important. I think they're massive. Just that love of reading, because that's what developed that interest for me, as well as my parents, you know, ridiculous library of amazing books by talented African-American and African authors. But school, I hope it's better now. I'll find out when my son starts in a few months, but I think school definitely needs to up its game, especially in a kind of school where I went to, where you had lots of mixed faces. You had kids of different colors. So is Dickens and, you know, the Mayor of Casterbridge, is that really what us African and Caribbeans need to be reading about when we're like 13, 14? I disagree, but, you know, I'm not an English teacher, but I think there was a trick missed there with the curriculum, but I'll I'll keep my mouth shut now and let you.
Oh, you don't have to. I mean, I can go. I rant as much as you do about the curriculum and, you know, the books that are in the curriculum. We have quite a few teachers in the book club, and the majority still say things are still the same. They have to fight to get diverse books on the curriculum. Things have changed a little, but I don't think they've changed that much. But hopefully, by the time that your son is in school, things will be much better. Now, going back to your writing, you said you write on the iPhone.
Yeah.
How do you manage to do that, and why?
It's I think the way my brain is wired, and part of it is my training, part of it is my personality. As a GP, I think 10 years ago, we used to have to write down for our appraisals all the places we've worked. Back then, I'd worked in over 85. This is over 10 years ago, different practices all over London. So that number has gone up significantly since. So I had to learn different IT systems. You know, the modern doctor has to be good with IT. Not even doctor. I think any profession, you need to have a grasp of IT. And, you know, on a practical, personal note, when you've got a kid in one hand who's sleeping, you've only got one hand free. So I can't type with one hand on a computer, and I couldn't, like, put him down. So it just so happened that I just had an iPhone, and you just put your thoughts on a page, which is a screen. And my wife finds it bizarre to this day. She doesn't understand how I do it. I don't see what's so strange about it. I just think the thought is there. You know, if you're shaving, which is ironically where most of my thoughts, writing thoughts, come to me, I just pick up my phone. I just stop, pick up my phone, write it down, carry on. Or if I'm listening to a radio program in between seeing patients in the car, a park, write it down. It's such a practical way to capture your thoughts. A laptop is great, but it's so impractical. Don't get me wrong, I've got a big phone. I probably couldn't have written on a Nokia from the 90s or early 2000s. I probably couldn't have written on one of those because I probably would have needed glasses by now. Mm-hmm. It's just a very practical way of getting your thoughts on a page. People find it bonkers, but I find it very practical. Like, I'm a very practical, not that I lack emotional intelligence, I've got plenty of that, but when it comes to getting something done, same way I force discipline on myself. It's a bit harder now, but with this book, I said to myself, every week, you're going to aim to write a chapter every week. If you don't be too hard on yourself, but try and write a chapter a week. Try and write, you know, within a time frame. A lot of people are like, oh, I spent 20 years writing this. I'm like, what are you doing for 20 years, man? Like, and that's like a lifetime and a half. Like, fair enough. I want to get stuff done. I want to get stuff out there. It doesn't mean I don't take my time editing it and correcting it, but I apply the same discipline that I have with my doctor work life with my writing. I know that as I'm learning very quickly, the publishing world does not have the rigid boundaries and structures of the NHS. People don't respond within like 48 hours. No one is gonna get sick if they don't respond to you after a month. They often don't. But in terms of my output, I think I still have that discipline. I take it as seriously for me what I do, the same way as I take my medical stuff, even though it's a very different world, but that's just the way my brain functions. And the martial arts has taught me that discipline as well.
How long does it take you then to write a book?
Good question. First one, which is about 192, I could be wrong, just under 200 pages, maybe just over. That took 6 months. That was actually the easiest to write because it was basically a pastiche of this fictional British Nigerian doctor working in this all these communities. It's basically about me, but with a fake name. The second one took about 9 months. This one took about a year. The one after, I finished it on July the 31st last year. I didn't start sending it out or trying to get interest till the end of last year because I don't send anything out until my wife has read it because I trust her implicitly, and she's a damn good editor. She will tell me if something, she won't use the word rubbish, but she will find a constructive, kind way of saying, I think you could do better with this. So until she's happy with something, it doesn't, no one else sees it. So I think probably I'd say nowadays, because I edit more as I go along. So I've become more of a perfectionist, which I don't think is a bad thing. I'm not saying that the output will be perfect, but in terms of the effort I put in. So probably about, I'd say at least a year now.
Well, that's actually a very short time. I mean, I've spoken to people, as you said earlier on, who Yeah, it took me 20 years, or it took me 5 years to write this. So yeah, a year is a really, really short period of time.
Nah, I'd lose my marbles if I spent 20 years writing, doing one thing. There's a guy called David Goggins, who's this Navy SEAL. He's an ultra marathon runner, African American guy. He's a massive inspirational speaker. And he says, if you really believe in something, you have to be a little bit bonkers. You have to be slightly obsessive about it. You have to really pour your heart and soul into it. And it couldn't take me 20 years if I was putting that much effort into one thing. It might take 20 years for it to see the light of day. But if it took 20 years for me to finish something, I'd be very disappointed in myself.
You set yourself very high standards. I can say that.
Well, if I don't, no one else is going to. No one owes me anything. So, and I'm representing. I mean, one thing I haven't said is this book is a love letter to, I guess, my son, but also my culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a debt of gratitude I owe to my parents and those that came before them. So if I don't put in the work and it's not a decent end product, then they'll never say, oh, okay, they're Nigerians. They probably will say it to my face. But if it's not good, then I feel like I've let other people down. I'm not writing it for them, but I know it means a lot to them, and I know I'm representing them. And that is not just them, but other Africans, Caribbeans, us as Black people generally. And that means a lot to me, and I hope it means a lot to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does mean a lot to me. I mean, as I said, I absolutely loved learning about a culture that I wasn't aware of. Actually, that reminds me, I wanted to ask after finishing reading the book, because I wanted to know a little bit more about, you know, the region, the area. And when I Googled Dabas, all I could come across online was about the festival. Mm. So I wanted to ask whether you've actually attended the festival.
No, not yet. There's not much you can find, and it's
yeah.
This is the I guess the sad thing about living away from there. Those that are there know the history. They've been like, oh yes, we learned about this, but in terms of finding written stuff, it's very, very, very difficult. But when you talk to people, they're like, oh yeah. But it's sad because we have a lot of good historians, but there isn't enough of that history, that's widely available.
Yeah.
It's just a show.
The other thing that I found annoying was that the majority of references were saying, oh, the Dabas was the result of the British.
No.
Whereas we all know it was pre-colonial, quite a few of them were referencing it, that it all started during the reign of Queen Victoria.
No, nonsense. No.
So I found that frustrating, but having a book like this at least goes to open people's minds.
Yeah,
and show people that actually these things were there way before colonial times.
Like I said, I want to move from this, look, the bronze statue that we stole and put in a museum, and then we had slavery. I want to smash that narrative to bits, because as Black people the world over, we have such a rich history. I heard that there's a film being made about Mansa Musa, you know, the wealthiest man ever. You know, there's so much suppressed history about our continent that it's almost like it was there, it stalled, and then it was suppressed. Yeah, I want to change that narrative. Apart from wanting to see it change in the future, I want to change the narrative of the past. And just, I know I'm writing fiction, but it's a start. Just to open people's eyes a bit to see, actually, there's a lot more to this dark continent, as you people call it, than what you realize.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll say it again, I'm grateful that there are people like you out there that are doing it. I know people sometimes look at fiction and think, oh, it's just fiction, it's just made up. But fiction is actually based on things that have happened and somebody's experience. So yeah, I'm really glad that you are writing about these things. Now, I'm going to come towards the end, unfortunately. I mean, I could talk to you about this and just writing in general. But I guess before I let you go, imagine you're in an airport lounge. You're about to take off to go somewhere nice for your holidays. And I was just wondering, what book would you take with you to read?
Okay, that's a tough question. Am I allowed one or two books?
Oh, as many as you want.
With a child, you'll only get through one if you're lucky on a long haul flight. I would say one would be anything by Ray Celestine, because he just takes you to another time. and another country and another place and another world. I just think it's amazing. Anything by Chimamanda Adichie, or when Ty Selassie brings out another book, we're waiting, just because their way with words is absolutely amazing. Okay, I lied. I'll take a third book. Anything by James Baldwin as well, because he's, those writers you wish they were, either you watch YouTube for hours or you just wish you could attend a theatre where they're just talking, or a lecture series they're giving, because, man, that I think I read The Fire Next Time a few months ago or last year, and I couldn't put it, it's a short book, but I couldn't put it down. Incredible writer. So I guess, yeah, one of those three. I'd probably cheat and then list a fourth and a fifth, but we'll stick to three for now.
And continuing on the flight theme, so you're on a long haul flight and your book has been turned into a film. So who do you like cast as the main characters? So if we go for Issa, the master, and maybe Amaka.
Okay, so I actually got asked this by the publisher. I wrote this long geeky list before the book came out, and I've already forgotten half of what I've written. I'll start with Amaka. It either have to be Lupita Nyong'o, because I think she's awesome. But then Danai Gurira is badass from Black Panther and The Walking Dead. She I don't know her, but she just seems hard as nails. But I think Lupita's got that tender side more. Mm-hmm. Master, I think I might get shot for saying this. I think Idris is now too old, but he can play Jibril Asari. there's a guy called Sope Dirisu. He's a Nigerian origin British actor in something called Gangs of London that's on Sky. This dude has just got this raw intensity that I can't really articulate. I think he's an incredible actor, and he's a Niger guy as well. So I think he would be, he's also the right age to play Master. Mm-hmm. I did think about Michael B. Jordan, but this other guy just, I'm waiting for Gangs of London season two, because he's just, when he's on the screen, I don't know about you, but there's something about seeing a black male or female actor where they just, the screen is on fire when they're there. Every scene this guy is on, when he's on the screen, you're just glued. So he would be perfect for Master. He's just got that grace, that poise. You've seen his fight scenes that he does in this series. The guy's got it all, and he's a brilliant actor. Issa is probably the hardest to cast, actually. I don't know. There is a brilliant actor from this series called This Is Us, but I'm not sure if he'd be too old to do it now. I don't know. I don't know who would play Issa. It's a tough one.
Yeah, I guess I'm being unfair, because Issa is quite a difficult one, given as we don't have as many children actors. So I am being cruel.
That's okay.
Where can listeners get hold of the book?
Yeah, so it is available from Waterstones, W.H. Smith, Blackwells, Foyles, Amazon. I thought I'd give a shout out to the independent bookstores as well. My local one, Primrose Hill Bookstore, is selling it. Where else? Thebookshop.org, you can find it.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think. So that's in the UK. In the US, Barnes & Noble. There's a few independent bookstores. There's Novel. There's another one in Texas. There's a handful. There's what, shelves in North Carolina. There's Malaprop, in Texas. There's another one called Deep Vellum. I'm just giving these guys a shout out because they were kind enough to stock it for me, so I have to say them out loud. Afrori Books, which I think is the UK's largest bookstore in Brighton, black bookstore, I should say, sells it. But yeah, you can get it online from Amazon and any of those other places. You can get it in, to my surprise, lots of countries around the world, actually. You can get it in Germany, France, some Asian countries. Yeah, so it's available worldwide online and in bookstores as well.
Uh-huh. And if readers want to get hold of you or follow you, where on social media can we find you?
I'm on Instagram and Twitter. I do a lot more stuff on Instagram than Twitter. At Remington Blackstaff on Instagram and at R Blackstaff on Twitter. That's where you'll find me. I tend to like post about books I like and have quotes and do more bookish stuff. So yeah, they can find me there. I'd be very grateful to be followed. I'd be quite flattered to be followed.
And finally, when can we expect the next book in the series?
right, I want to have that done. Initially, I thought by September, but realistically by the end of the year. And then it's just about getting it out there. And in the meantime, the one I finished last year, I'm actively trying to get that one out there. That one is a very different, but I think you'll enjoy it just as much for different reasons. But yeah, and then I think once I'm done with the Durbert sequel, I will move straight on to part three, because great things come in threes. So yeah.
I am so looking forward to it.
Thank you.
And I actually, even the one that's you've already written, the one that's not in the series, I'm looking forward to reading that because I want to see what else you can do.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your time and thank you for joining.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed this or any of our other episodes, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And don't forget to share. Till next time, bye-bye.